tonight we have another great show dealing with metaphysics, particularly tonight some interesting physics and science and spirituality, of course, and things about God tonight that are interesting. And if you're interested in physics, you're going to probably be interested in tonight's show. And if you're interested in God and physics, you're going to be even more interested. And I thought we would talk about God's something from nothing, colon, polarity, spins, mass, and movement. Yes, that's a long title. And the basic idea of this is to talk about how does conventional or modern, or however you might want to call it, some of the standard model and other kinds of models of physics, fit in with God. And the bigger issue, which cannot be answered by physics, is how does something come from nothing? And God figured that out, of course, before there was a universe, or else we wouldn't exist. But the interesting thing about this in tonight's show is that I'm not going to get into math or real complicated things. I may only use a few technical terms in physics. I'm going to talk about things in conceptual terms. So for people who aren't really that interested in that sort of stuff, you won't be that put off or bored by tonight's show. And for the rest of you who have some interest in it, you're probably going to say, yeah, I've been waiting for this. You wonder when he's going to talk about it. Well, tonight's going to be the night, so I thought we'd do that. Okay, let's start off, as I usually do, by defining things, which is usually difficult, and that's why I do it in the beginning of the show, because let's face it, halfway through or longer, people have heard a lot, and they are not wanting to hear more definitions and stuff. Okay, so what are we talking about? Polarity, spins, mass, movement has to do with God. Well, there's only three parts to God, if you are thinking about God's creation of our universe. And those three parts are creation itself, which you can call a lot of different things. Some people refer to it as the first part of God's mind. And it comes from the originality of what is God, and that is God is a self-created being. It's very important to understand that. How did it do that? Well, it did that because it, through being in an infinite field of possibilities to begin with, and not being God yet, not even being a creator yet, the choices within that field that were similar and moving in a similar direction, you might say, became a being by being able to limit the field through the direction of the choices alone. So in other words, if a lot of choices are being made consistently in a similar direction together, then those choices become something. They become first, we can call it sort of, so to speak, a being, a great being, and then we could claim that that great being eventually becomes a creator if it chooses to create more than something other than itself. So what I'm saying is something is a being, something is a director of a field of choices, which we can call a being, just because it does that. But it isn't a creator until it chooses to do what God did, which is to create a whole new field. And on its own, make new kinds of unique, for itself at least, choices that make the universe that we think we live in, we live in a much wider and bigger one than the one that we think of right now, most people, and this universe is God's creation, and so therefore it is a creator. God would probably say it creates life, and that's what its big deal is about. But that is its next step. It creates a field that has the capability of supporting life. And then the next thing it does is it creates the conditions for life to create itself. It doesn't exactly create the life. It just creates the conditions for life to create itself. And then life becomes the opportunity for the creator to grow instead of it growing itself. Because if it just grew itself, then it wouldn't be a creator anymore. It'd just be a being that is directing a field, and that would be kind of boring. So it wants to create something that has independence of choice, freedom of choice. And that's the reason there's evil, by the way. That's the reason there's good and evil. Because in order for there to be freedom of choice, there has to be the choice to not accept or even believe in or maybe even want to destroy God. Even though God wants a universe of life that creates more of it, some of that life has a choice, if it chooses to, of course, to do the opposite or to do none of the above. And God is recognizant or cognizant of that fact. And that's how come evil can exist in a universe where there is all the love of God, which we're going to be talking about. So the first part of God's mind is this creation business. It's a fantastic thing. And it's without creation, there really wouldn't be anything else going on. So God wanted more stuff going on, and so it created. And then it allows, although it doesn't force, the life that eventually is self-created, just as God was, by all the choices in the universe coming together in our universe. The results are that life has a great opportunity, a tremendous opportunity to grow more of its creator in various ways. Now, I'm giving the simple thumbnail approach. There's a much more complicated explanation about life and God and how life grows and how evolution fits into that and how it's not what most people think it is. And it's not against God, and it doesn't explain how the universe works without a God. It doesn't do either of those things. But what it does do is explain the mechanism that God created so that there could be life. So it's a good thing. Okay, but there's a lot more about this that I'm not going to go into because it's not really about that tonight. Tonight we're getting into how something comes from nothing in our universe and how this fits into physics and modern-day science and a lot of other issues that we're going to move into. Okay, so the wonderful part about this great experiment that God has created is that we're only moving from just the first part of God's mind, and already I could talk for hours and hours and hours about what this first part of God's mind does. But we don't have the time for that, so I'm going to jump to the second part of God's mind, which we could talk for more hours and hours and hours and hours about, and that's the ability to become inclusive and conscious. Consciousness. What is consciousness? Consciousness is understanding. Consciousness is inclusiveness. Consciousness is love and givingness. All of those things are part of consciousness and vice versa. Consciousness is the awareness that something is. And then the awareness that other things are, and finally the awareness that everything is, including its own creator. Wow. Wow. And you might say, well, I thought you said God didn't create everything. He made it possible for things to become self-created. Yeah, but if God didn't make that possible, there wouldn't be that other thing. So God did create everything in some respect. God just didn't get into the micromanagement of creation. Okay. So, here we have a very interesting issue, a very interesting fact, that consciousness is the second part of God's mind, and which is part in part love. And when I talk about love, I talk about a universal love, not love necessarily on the very minimal scales that a lot of people think of in a personal way. And so, here we have these two parts, and all of a sudden something really big happens because of the two parts of it. Okay. And the first part is creative. The second part is inclusive, which means it gives direction to the creativity. Remember, that's what created God in the first place, was having those two things. And so you got to have the first part of God's mind, or you cannot have any new life. New life, other than God, would come from the first two parts of God's mind coming together. Mm-hmm. They come together. And when they come together, they produce a couple of different things. And that's where tonight's show starts coming into it. First of all, they start producing a thing called polarity. Now, what is polarity? Polarity is the definition of how you find direction. You cannot understand or really perceive of direction if there's no polarity. Direction is moving from one place to another. But the problem with that is there has to be polarity. One side has to be different from the other, or there couldn't be any movement from one to the other. See? So polarity has a great meaning. It's much bigger in terms of spiritual principles than it is in terms of things like electrical issues and physics. They're very narrow in comparison to understanding polarity. And so polarity is a big deal. And polarity allows there to be the first thing on our list after polarity, and that's spins. You might say, well, wait a second. How does direction give spin? Well, it does, and I'll explain it in this way. When something has polarity, its movement, other than in a perfectly straight line, produces spin. The things that do not have spin to them have to only move in a perfect straight line, but never can curve in either direction. Okay? It kind of makes sense if you think about it. You want to move from point A to point B. Okay. And you have a choice. You could say, you could go in a perfectly straight line, if there is such a thing, really. And in our understanding, very basically, of geometry, if you're talking about a plane and not a non-Euclidean geometry, which would throw things off, but if you talk about a plane, then ultimately you would end up going in a straight line from point A to point B, and you would not develop a spin in that relatively unusual circumstance. But most of the time, when various kinds of things that eventually come into existence, because God actually was the creator of these things, but through a system, those majority of things actually move in a curve from point A to B. Sometimes a very steep curve, sometimes a minor curve. But as soon as they start curving, there is more, we'll call it movement or force in movement, more vector kinds of energies on one side of whatever it is than there is on the other side. And this results in a thing called spin. Ah! So direction leads a majority of the time to creating some kind of spin. And there's two kinds of spin. There's a kind of spin that moves, we'll call it, to one's left. And there's a kind of spin that moves towards one's right. And these two spins have a proclivity for either the first part of God's mind, which is at one point of our direction, or the second part of God's mind, which is at the second point always, and that produces consciousness. So when you go from being a creator to being a conscious being, and the two actually go hand in hand to some extent, at that point, in that situation, you are either moving perfectly straight, which is okay. If you're doing that, you don't have a spin. And if you're moving with, we'll say, to the left, we'll just make this up, but it's kind of true, then the spin would be more towards the direction of the second point that you're moving towards, whereas if you're moving towards the right, then you would have a tendency, a propensity to move towards the originating point. Okay? I hope you're following me so far, but if you're not, this will kind of make sense in a few minutes. Okay, so spin kind of is created by these unusual movements that could happen to something that is going from one point to another, and the points are really choices. So if you're moving from one choice to another, you can either move towards the direction with a proclivity towards the second choice, or you can move towards the proclivity of the first choice that you started with. If you move towards the proclivity of the second choice, you are more affected by the direction of the choices, and if you are moving more, your proclivity is to move, or literally stay, towards the direction of the first choice, then you would say that at that point, you actually are more of a creative choosing person, less affected by direction, but more affected by creation, more affected by the first part of God's mind than the second. Now you could say, well, that's all interesting. Well, what does that got to do with us? Well, it has a lot to do with a lot of things, because this is the beginning of sex. And that's sex in a operative fashion, but sex in a definitive fashion. Because those things that have a tendency to, we'll say, be willful or tenacious with their choice or choices tend to be of the spin that tends to go to the right, if we were making this up correctly. Right and left are a little hard to understand about the universe, but we'll just call it that. And we tend to call this, in our vernacular, male. And those things that go to the left and that, in our vernacular, tend to move and change choice more easily and are more mitigating in their will. In other words, they may adopt the wills of others or change their will more easily. Those are, we call, female. Starting to make a little bit of sense? Maybe. Maybe some of you who may think this is true, others may disagree and say, well, women are exactly like men. Are they? Okay. All right. So this is how things kind of get started about what we call in metaphysics, the beginning of the creation of sexuality in life. Now, remember, not everything, and therefore not all life, would have either one of these characteristics. There's some kinds of life that do not have sexuality. We should be aware of that. And there's also some kinds of life that sometimes are very ambivalent and can move back and forth between male and female. So you should be aware of that as well. It's particularly amphibians seem to like that a lot. But at any rate, that's it's an interesting thing that the sex of some things can change. So now you can say, well, what is this? Okay, this is cool, but what does this have to do in terms of something from nothing business? And how does this all come into play? Because, you know, okay, so it sounds like there's some basic things in how the universe works, and it's important to know these things because they're the fundamental aspects of a lot of things that later on I've talked about in the show in the past and people hear about or read about in terms of metaphysics or physics. So it kind of explains both to some degree, okay? So, now, let me continue on. And I like the slowness that I'm going in. I hope I'm not going too slow for some people. But because I am able to give examples and let people kind of mull this over so they can think about it in their own heads. Okay, so we got perfectly straight lines that go from one choice to another. And those we call kind of asexual beings, asexual life of some sorts. There's all kinds of asexual lives. And then there's life that has a male or female component to that kind of life, and it's a sexual kind of life. Now, this is pretty cool because it allows a lot of different kind of life to really develop itself into different things. Remember, it's creating itself. And some life can move from being sexual to asexual if it cares to. So that's another interesting part of this whole process. Okay. So how does something come from nothing? Well, we've got these two thoughts, coming from God's mind. And they involve choices and direction to the choices. And these choices and direction to the choices immediately start having one of three kinds of reactions to their existence. They either react as a male, female, or asexual. Just right off the bat, that's like what happens. Wow, that's pretty cool. An asexual can combine and be part of both. So, wow, it's just out of nothing, we already have something. And you might not think it's that important, but it actually plays a major role in how God creates life, or creates the space for life to be in, if you really want to be technical. Okay, so this mechanism is just incredibly simple, yet efficient. And it isn't until you get to the third part of God's mind that you start seeing how really important it all is. What's the third part of God's mind? Well, in the third part of God's mind, you have to have something added. And the added part is energy. The first two parts we call spirit when energy's around. If there's no energy that spirit can react with, it's no longer spirit. It actually becomes part of a being called the One. And that being, the One, is actually asexual. It's called a monad. Monad. And it was kind of invented, the name itself was invented by a fairly famous philosopher. But the important thing about monads, and the One, as the monad, was talked about long before this philosopher existed, for millions of years, the One has been known about. I don't think its name was actually called the monad, unless others had invented the name and he reinvented it. But at any rate, okay, so what are these beings? They're kind of like pretty cool beings because they exist in their own part of the universe called the second plane of existence. And they actually have some very interesting elements to them. First of all, as we said, they are composed of male and female, and they're asexual, so they're kind of put together themselves. But they exist on a plane that has a feminine spin to it to some extent because it's the second plane. However, they divide their spins at 180 degrees. So by dividing their spins at 180 degrees, it negates all elements of their sexual proclivity, and consequently, they don't have any sexual spin. So they move in two directions at the same time, in opposing directions. For those of you who have read Chapter 4, Enlightened Hidden Meaning, you know exactly what I'm talking about because there's a whole bunch of pages in that chapter talking about how monads move in two directions at the same time, in their mind, and the thought process, and their movement, and then how they function together. And so this is not new news to you guys, but the rest of everybody who's listening, they haven't read that textbook, and so as far as they're concerned, what the hell is this guy talking about? Okay, so we got these monads. And the third part of God's mind is also given to them. They have access to the third part of God's mind. But they decide that where they are is just cool. And they don't want to grow their life where they are. They want to be more like their creator, but they know the creator needs their assistance. So they decide to create something called spirit, and from the third part of God's mind, which they completely ignore, but they hold at some point around themselves in the second plane. Actually, it surrounds them, but they don't interact with it. That third part which is called intelligent activity, where they're at. The activity is in a state of perfection where they are. But they decide that they're going to allow lower life, that they're going to help to provide the right vehicles for to create itself. They're going to go ahead and take this intelligent activity that isn't doing much of anything because they're not interacting with it. And intelligent activity needs spirit to work with to create any kind of life. And they say, okay, intelligent activity, you're out of here. And as soon as they say, you're out of here, some of the intelligent activity becomes energy, but not in their dimension. It becomes energy in the next dimension, the spiritual plane. Some people call it the atmic plane. You know, there's all kinds of names for it. Nirvana. Yeah, that's another name. And so you have this energy suddenly, this literally appears from no place. Now, how does it appear from no place? Well, because the monads have decided not to be creative with it and to through their own thought, project its use for all life that they're going to help to allow to create itself in the lower dimensions, they say, here's your gift. Here's our gift to you. We are giving you all this huge amount of energy, although they don't give it all at one time because it would overwhelm the life and become too forceful. So they, along with other lower beings eventually, decided how much energy every kind of life is really going to need, which is okay. It's cool. There's actually some beings that live on this atmic plane, right below the monadic plane, and they do a lot of the deciding. Some of those beings used to be human beings, yeah? But those beings are really, really far advanced from human beings now. And so that's our future, in a sense. And they get to choose how and what kinds of energy. And then eventually what kind of forms or what kind of planets and what kind of star systems certain kinds of energy are going to be modeled into, and the dominance of one type over another is going to create a certain kind of room for various kinds of life forms to grow in. Wow! They're going to do all that. So when you think that evolution is some kind of like throw the dice and watch what's going to happen, no way. Evolution, there is freedom for the life forms to do a lot of creating on their own. But what planet and all the whole thing and how it's all designed and everything, all that stuff is figured out way ahead of time. And life forms have absolutely nothing to say about it. That's right. Okay? All right. So, cool as it sounds, it is. Another thing that's really going on, it's really cool, on this third plane of reality, which is called the Atmic or Nirvanic or whatever you like. Yeah, okay. The third plane of reality is the third part of God's mind. It represents, the whole plane is represented by a being that kind of controls the whole plane, called a Ray Lord. But, you know, you don't have to remember that. It's just that there's, for everything in the universe has like its own existence place. And so you don't think that anything is just done haphazardly. Everything is being created by something that is part of life and part of helping to grow God. It's really cool. Now, there's another little thing, a little twist in all this. God is so open-minded that it said, hey, not only am I going to create my own universe, that I'm going to have life in it that is going to be free to create itself and then choose what it wants to do within the laws that I create in pre-life. If it goes against those laws, it may kill itself, but that's its own choice. But it allows all this to go on. But it also allows an openness to other universes where there are beings that function beyond any being will ever function in this universe. And some of those beings would like in to our universe to experience some of the things in our universe while they also got stuff going on elsewhere. And our God says, sure. Hey, I'm an inclusive God. Inclusion is my second name. Whoa, that's me. So it allows these beings to come into the third plane as well, where all this energy and spirit is coming from the monads. You know, And they come into the third plane, and then they communicate and help to, in a very strange way, create monads in the second plane. And the way they do this is that it's a little tricky. Let me try to explain. First, they create a body for themselves, okay? And this body brings together a whole bunch of energy from the atomic plane. And eventually this energy works its way down, 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 until it gets to the physical plane where all of us are living right now. And that's how, eventually, there is energy put into the plane we're on. Now, there has to be a collection of these beings working along with God and trying to produce a universe. And the collection of these beings say, you know what? We're not going to come into the universe to mess around and create problems. We'll just follow this system of creating a body for ourselves on five planes of existence, the Atmic, Buddhic, or intuitional, some people prefer that name, Manasic or mental, astral, and then finally the etheric physical. Yeah, I know, that's a lot of metaphysics, but they said that that's where they're going. That's they plan of making a body in those parts of the of God's universe. And God's cool with this. God says, great, go ahead. Yeah, yeah, I want more diversity, and you guys come from all these different universes, so that's really cool. And they say, but, you know, we don't want to come into the universe with our own consciousness. And so they kind of say, well, you know, we would like to have spirit and energy coming from God, but we want it dependent upon the consciousness of a being that is going to be part of the God's universe that they're coming into. And so, in this case, our God's universe. And so they say, let us create a mirror of God in God's thought and a mirror of our thought together, kind of focusing on both. And so this mirror becomes the monads. And the monads become particular to the being that came, that's coming into our universe to create a body for itself. And you know what that body eventually becomes in the physical universe? Although it's actually, it has a body that's much larger than the physical part we see. The physical part we see is called a star. But in other parts of the universe, they have even other names for it. But it's all part of one star, because the star exists, like humans exist on three planes of existence, but the star exists on five, plus the monad's consciousness specific to that specific star. So all the monads that are created on a specific part of the physical world, the physical universe, have a connection to a particular star system, and those monads are that star's kind of life consciousness, and they are stay connected for all the time that star remains. Now, they may go on to different star systems as a collective group after they are with a single star, but they don't go from one single star to another unless that star is reincarnating, and it does it two additional times. So you could say the monad sticks around for three kinds of stars, one, two, and three. They're very different kind of stars. And sometimes there's more. There's some exceptions to what I'm talking about. I know it's getting complicated and difficult here. And so they stick around because that star or those stars are connected to this one being that's coming from another universe, and they are a reflection of that being's consciousness and our God's consciousness, but that being's consciousness still remains outside of our universe in and of as it was to begin with. So they're a reflection, but they're a reflection that starts creating on their own in our universe, and they don't any longer have direct contact with this being in the outside universe, the other universe they came from. This is to protect our universe from becoming too affected by other universes, but at the same time, it gives other universes a chance to experience our universe and it gives more creation. It produces more creation in our universe than if it didn't happen this way. Wow. You didn't know that, did you? So our God is so incredibly inclusive and open-minded that while it is truly creating its own universe, it says, hey, come on, come one, come all. As many stars as there are, there's trillions and trillions of stars, right? All those stars are the invites from beings that are very, 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 very far advanced from human beings that exist in other more advanced universes that are having an opportunity to experience something of our universe by having a body in our universe that we call a star. And they take some of the energy that the monads release from their plane, and they take some of the spirit the monads release. So you get some of the thought of the monads. You get some of the energy that the monads are allowing for life to develop. And these beings use this energy to eventually create stars. And stars have energy from the third plane to the seventh plane of our universe. Amazing. And there are three basic classes of stars with some subclasses. You could say there's like seven to make stars. And each of these classes of stars has a life cycle. And a star goes through three specific life cycles. Some of them go kaboom, and some don't. Some do certain things because they develop different kind of planetary systems for different kind of life. And that means different kind of monads. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's really cool. Really, really cool. Some monads that want to create a lot of physical life would be in a certain kind of planetary system. Others might not want to do that. They might say, well, you know, that isn't too interesting to me. So they might try something else. It's really interesting. But this allows complete diversity, and diversity is a tremendously good thing. Well, at this point, we are coming towards our break. So I think maybe I will give you a chance to let the old noodle cool down and let you hear a commercial or two. And then when we come back, I'm going to tell you how all of this then develops our physical universe, something from nothing, and then how this really directly affects us. I know this is way out there right now. People are saying, well, I thought this show was supposed to have some practical things, right? And, yeah, we're going to talk about practical things. But right now, we're talking about that way out stuff that sometimes I like to have shows about. So there we are. Okay. We'll be back. In about 2 minutes and 30 seconds from about right now.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. McFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning, This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight we're talking about heavy-duty metaphysical stuff and some physics that's going to come in, too. And also some really high-minded stuff that a lot of people don't know about, but they wish they did. Some of them did, anyway. And there isn't much written about this stuff because it is so hard to understand that people of 100, 200, 500 years ago, majority of people couldn't understand it. It just gets too convoluted and difficult for people to carry in their minds. People weren't conscious enough then. Now, you guys, I think, are. You're listening to me, hopefully. Okay, so we left off our story about beings coming in from other universes and in a great field of diversity, trillions and trillions of them come in and add some diversity to the system, which is just wonderful because God wants diversity because this helps God to grow. These beings are coming from higher level universes than the one that God has, the God of our universe, created. Higher level because our universe only has three parts to God's mind, but these other universes have four or more parts to the gods of their universe's minds. So they're more complicated, and they bring all kinds of different ways of creating life, potential ways. And this is a good thing. God's very happy about it, I'm sure. Okay, so, and we should be very happy because it allows this tremendous diversity, which is helpful. Now, some of the stars are more similar to each other than others because some of the universes are more similar to each other than our others. So there's almost a category. Because there's seven kinds of universes. There are seven kinds of stars. It's a very interesting understanding, I'd say. Okay. So this energy that initially comes in is a kind of energy that is very, very basic. It's just kind of learning the ropes of being energy, because after all, it was intelligent activity before it was energy. And then it suddenly becomes unintelligent activity, meaning that it doesn't really understand much about anything. And the energy reacts with other energy through wanting to be inclusive, using the second part of God's mind in the most basic of all ways. This basic way is just to get together with other energy that's around and say, hey, I'm over here, you're over there, let's get together. And so their desire to get together, literally, produces something that we're familiar with. We call it gravity. Wow. So gravity is coming from the second part of God's mind being emphasized. You could say it's the feminine part of God's mind. Produces gravity. Gravity comes from things in our part of the universe, which is the lowest and densest part, that have mass. And the more mass they have, the more gravity they have. Sounds interesting. And not coincidentally, most people refer to Earth and other planets in a feminine way. Now, that's a very interesting idea. I'm not talking about astrological, because astrology says some planets are feminine, some are masculine. But I'm saying that, that in a more basic way, people refer to planets as a feminine kind of, a feminine kind of thing. And so it's an interesting correlation how we come to that subconsciously, even in our deepest past. Energy is a component of the third part of God's mind, and there become two kinds of energy. There is the elemental part of energy, which is really the kind of energy that just produces the gravity, and it's very feminine in its approach. But then there's the kind of energy that responds to the choice side of God's mind more. And this is a more masculine quality to it, and it's called devonic, some people call it angelic, energy. And this energy is group conscious, meaning that it seeks the choices of others in making its own choices. So it does lead eventually to following directions, but it's very creative. It wants to be more creative, so it's inclusive with others for the purpose of being creative rather than for the purpose of just being with others. And because it has those qualities to it, it has both. It wants to be inclusive, but it also is creative. It has consciousness. And the energy that is really not creative on its own has not yet been able to develop consciousness. So we say that elemental energy is not conscious, and devonic energy has some level of consciousness to it. Oh, very interesting. And you notice that all of this is happening because of those basic things about that we talked about God's mind, having direction and a starting point and a polarity and eventually spin, and now we're talking about mass. Mass comes from energy getting together. Isn't that cool? Yeah, the mass is coming from energy getting together. And we call the beginning of what mass produces after it all gets together gravity. And gravity is one of the four kinds of forces in the universe, but it is the most pervasive and most universal of all the forces. And the weakest. It's weak because there is very little consciousness behind the force. It's being created by energy that doesn't have consciousness or has very minimal amounts, depending upon what plane we're talking about. And the interesting thing is that the more energy develops mass, the lower its level of consciousness, not the higher. That sounds strange, but that's the way it works. So when you have more mass and more density to the mass, because there's more gravity, then the result is very, very low levels of consciousness, even compared to energy that has relatively low mass, like that is found on the atomic plane. Is very, 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 very low in mass, very, very low in gravity. The energy that is found here in the physical world, very, very high in mass, very, very high in gravity. But that means very low in consciousness. So in order to get the energy to make movement that has any kind of level of intelligence, meaning that it communicates and helps life to grow, you've got to have this devonic energy making creative choices for the relatively low consciousness elemental energy that isn't able to do much of anything other than get itself together and become something that has mass to it. Okay, so isn't that interesting? I find, you know, a lot of people say, well, where does all this stuff come from that when we talk about physics and metaphysics, and most people don't have an answer for it, but I do. How do you like that? Okay. Now, how does this fit in with physics? I'm going to spend about 10 minutes, maybe 12, talking about physics now. Yeah, and then I'll give you a brain cooler for a few minutes to relax, and we'll come back and kind of combine these together and talk about them as far as how they affect us in our life and what the technological future will become, how we can apply these in various ways. There's all kinds of stuff we'll talk about. Okay. So we now have some idea of why this show is named Polarity, Spins, Mass, and Movement, right? Because I just explained that that's all what's going on with all this energy business. The third part of God's mind interacting with the first two parts, or spirit. Hey, that's pretty cool. Okay. But in physics of recent times, ever since the early to mid-60s, there was a group of about 4 to 6 physicists that got together. If you include Einstein in it, it's probably 6 physicists. But he was dead at the time these other guys got together, but they used a lot of his stuff. And so, and they said, you know, there has to be some way. They had the same issues, though. How do you create things? How does something come from nothing? And so they worked on it from quantum physics, the side of quantum physics. And they created this thing called the standard model of physics. They helped to create it with their thoughts. Recently, last year, they won the Nobel Prize for some of their ideas. So, I mean, it just takes a long time to win a Nobel Prize. I mean, even though they did it in the 60s and they refined it a little bit in the 70s, it took a while. And one of the scientists' name was a fellow named Higgs, Peter Higgs. And Pete decided that, you know, he kind of introduced something that was very creative. He said there has to be a mechanism that allows what we call mass to come into existence. Because he recognized that at the beginning of the universe, there was no mass to anything, even at the Big Bang. What we think of as that massive thing that must have created everything, it didn't have any mass. It had zero mass. It had energy, but there was no mass yet. And he said, well, how did a mass come about? And so he said, I'll bet you there's some kind of field that is produced because fields have the characteristic of being creators. And he knew that this is a creative process he was talking about. Then later in the 70s, an anomaly came up that furthered his ideas about this. And that anomaly was that they discovered if there was a Big Bang, and by the 70s they were convinced there was because they had discovered noise about the Big Bang back 10 years earlier, or 15 years earlier. And so, and those guys also won a Nobel Prize for that. So he kind of got this whole thing together. He said, okay, here's the deal. And by the way, these guys also won some super prize in physics. So they won some big stuff, lots of money. What they want. Okay, so here's the situation. It turned out that as a particle physicist, we were inventing all these particles, or at least discovering them, or however you want to figure it. They finally worked their way back to the point where they knew there was likely a Big Bang. But there was a problem. And the problem was that when they started playing with all the different particles and how they got made and everything, and they started dealing with space and time issues about the manufacture of particles in space and time, they discovered that at the beginning of the physical part of our universe, which you call the Big Bang, there was a thing called inflation. Well, what does that mean? No, it's not how much they had to pay for the Big Bang. It didn't suddenly become more expensive. But what happened was, remember, part of this whole process is polarity, spin, mass, and movement. Well, part of it says movement is part of the whole process of how energy is starting to create things so life can eventually become out of the process. the movement at the beginning of the universe is, in fact, anti or against Einstein's notion of nothing being able to go faster than the speed of light. Because within the first few seconds after the Big Bang, the universe expanded to a size that's almost incomprehensible. Like in the first second, it was bigger than our whole solar system. And if the next second, it was between us and the next star in size and circumference. And then the next second, it was like as big as a quarter of our galaxy or something. I mean, these are huge numbers, way, way larger than the speed of light. I mean, millions of times faster than the light travels and, you know, at the speed of light. And the problem with that is that you have a difficulty because at the speed of light, all mass keeps getting converted back into energy. And so what they figured was that there couldn't be any mass until the universe fell below the speed of light. That was the first problem that they were looking at. But the basic problem was, how did this field of energy move faster than the speed of light? Because even energy is not supposed to move faster than the speed of light. We're not just, because energy and mass are convertible, so energy shouldn't go faster than the speed of light either. And here at the beginning of the universe, we've got to go millions of times faster. So something ain't right. And so what Peter Higgs said is, what if there's a mechanism, which he later called the Higgs mechanism, and I wonder why, that causes or prevents the creation of any kind of actual speed-limiting device and allows energy to move much, much, much faster than light, and obviously there would be no light in that universe in our universe at that time until everything fell at or below the speed of light. Okay, because light couldn't exist in it, so there'd be no light. So he kind of looked at this, and he imagined this field like a field of molasses. Okay, and the field itself was created by something which he never has been able to name. I call it God, or you could call it beings from other universes working with God, and monads, and all the other things. But they're all part of God. You know? So God's thought is involved in this whole thing. And what God did, it's a really amazing thing. God said, okay, I'll let this universe have a big bang, and all this energy can enter the universe. But I'm not going to focus my attention on any part of the first X number of seconds or minutes or hours that this universe is developed, allowing this thing called inflation to take place so the universe could expand itself very rapidly. And then at the point where we call the Higgs field begins and the Higgs mechanism starts taking place. This is not at the Big Bang. This is seconds, minutes, even more later. After the Big Bang, then it enters this field that now is God's direct thought coming through, usually monads and other beings, including a thing called the Raeburn. And this collective thought produces a slowing down that allows the energy to now follow the thought, and the thought is to become saturated by what the field is about, which is love. So God does not focus its love on the beginning of our universe. it only focuses its creation with no love. And we have the first and third parts of God's mind coming into play for the first X period of time. This is still debatable how long this is. There's still some questions. And the second part of God's mind is this huge Higgs field. We'll call it love field. It's a love field, a field of love. That's like a thick molasses that causes everything to start collecting itself together, and it causes atoms to be formed from very iffy kinds of particles. And it allows the universe to start developing the things that are going to be needed in the physical world, in physical dimension, to become life here. And this happens in the Big Bang and after. And so it's all about energy following thought, and in this case, it's two kinds of thought. It's the Creator's, it's God's thought at the Big Bang's part, and it's the thought of the remaining parts of the co-creators with God that exist in the universe at the beginning of our physical part of the universe. And these beings create what we call the Higgs field. It's just another name for love. As soon as all of this love hits it, then you've got the opportunity to start creating the things that are needed to create stars, which is you got to have atoms, and the atoms eventually become, over time, mostly hydrogen, some helium atoms, and some lithium atoms. Very few of them. And those are the lightest elements. And they start collecting and become various kinds of gases that eventually mix, and they, over time, because there's all this love around, they become very gravitational. Gravity starts overpowering all the elements of the Big Bang, and that means the Big Bang was much more powerful than we ever expected it. So our numbers are going to probably have to change about that, because we're seeing the effects of the Big Bang from the other side of the Higgs field, where the love is slowing everything down, and we have, and slower means less energy. So we don't know really what the Big Bang was like from our perspective, because we're in the field of love that changed the beginning of creation for the physical plane. Whoa. Now that has a little difference. That kind of changes everything about Higgs fields. And if you believe Higgs particles exist, then they may not. I don't think they do. But whether they do or they don't, it changes everything about what people think about this, because everything is following the thought of God and those that are co-creating with God. It's not really following some kind of, whatever you want to call it, some kind of energy or something. It isn't. It's following thought. Energy is following thought. And this is the basic principle, energy follows thought, that ends up controlling everything, especially when we're talking about the inception of our universe, of the physical part of the universe. But this same thing has been played out on other planes. It has different outcomes because of different physics. But still, this business about energy following thought is actually now based upon what I just described as how the physical dimension is actually made. So when I say, you know, one of the basic metaphysical laws is energy follows thought greater than its own, then that makes, and its own thought is predominant, is dominated by gravity at this time. Because the divonic energies have only minimal effects, and divonic energies are created by life. So there's no divonic energies until there's some kind of life creation going on. Okay, so this is a fascinating outcome. The fascinating outcome is that ultimately what physics is struggling with, which is how do you get something from nothing? They're trying to solve the problem. They're trying to do it without spirit. They're trying to do it without God's thought and those things that are godly thinking. And they're never going to do it because that's what does it. So they're looking for something that's right in front of them, and it's all around them, but they don't see it, and so they can't figure out the answers to a lot of questions that they have, and they just keep getting circular in their thinking. Every time you discover a new particle or a new this or that or prove some more about the Higgs mechanism or the Higgs field, they still can't find the Higgs particle, but and there may not be one, as I said. But it doesn't matter that the results are that you don't end up with a solution to the problem. How does something come from nothing? It doesn't work. It just doesn't solve your problem. It's like you're just inventing another step towards infinity of never finding the answer, which is sticking you right in the face. Okay. So that's very interesting. And before we take a little break here, I just want to mention to you that it's important at this point at least, to realize that all of you guys out there, by listening to the show, are way ahead of where physics is today. I know the physicists can talk circles around all the different kind of particles, and they do this and that, and they have all those things. The fact of the matter is, it's just a bunch of stuff. But it doesn't tell you any real concepts, and it doesn't give you any real answers. It's like you know the names of every kind of thing in the universe, but the names of those things don't tell you anything about what they really do or how they function. They just know the names. It's nice. You know, you can sit there all day and just name them. Okay, so I want you to be aware of that, and that something does come from nothing, but it's God's something. It's not Peter Higgs' something. Peter Higgs is a pretty cool guy, though. He came up with a lot of good stuff. But it's not the stuff that necessarily those people are coming up with that solves the problem. Okay, so I'll give you a little break here. I'm going to just tell you we're moving ahead. 5G GZIC, we're finally getting it out there. We now have to establish a means of letting people know more about it. We're trying to do some networking with people, et cetera. And because this stuff really works. I used some today, as a matter of fact. I had kind of a little stiffness. I walked 4 miles this morning with a member of the spiritual group I'm in. And we were walking around the neighborhood. And it was pretty cold outside, so my legs were kind of stiff and everything. I took some GZIC. I took 4 of the tablets. And about a half hour later, I didn't have any stiffness. You know, I had just woken up. I was kind of not even awake yet. And so that was, for me, that's a great result because they're herbs and they're working. Now, it's a very minor kind of pain, but they will also work on very major kinds of pain. Last week, I mentioned that if you're using and are addicted to drugs, this is not the thing to get you off of drugs. You really got to work on that with your doctor. As a substitute, pain substitute, once you start getting through the withdrawals of your drug or drugs you're addicted to, you can use 5-HT GZIC as a great pain reliever, and it will work. But it's not going to get rid of the serious, serious pain that people experience from drugs. And you should be aware, I'm speaking more as a psychotherapist at this point and talking and dealing with many people who had drug problems at various times, that people experience the withdrawal from a drug as the pain that they were trying to treat from the drug itself. So it's a very, very, very sly thing, the pain, because the person doesn't realize that what they think is their pain is actually the withdrawal from the drug. So it's almost impossible to evaluate or determine whether something's going to help you to substitute for the drug. Well, I think I'll take an aspirin instead. You never know it because you're going to be in such discomfort from the pain of the withdrawal. And you start going into withdrawal in literally minutes to hours after you the drug is worn off and you'll feel the effects from it if you're addicted. And addicted is dependence. Anytime you say, well, I have to have this drug, like, at least every couple days, maybe every couple hours, but I got to have it sometime to deal with my pain. Well, that's dependence, and that's addiction. There's both psychological ones and there's physiological. The physiological have even more problems, because if you try to get off the drug, not only do you experience the pain that you may have had, and may still have, if the drug was supposedly getting better, but you also experience the results, unfortunately, of withdrawal from some substances that causes the body to go into sort of a shock state. It causes the adrenal to kind of collapse. And you don't really, you have pains from bad physical symptoms that the body can't deal with because it has become dependent on the drug. And also the divinic energies that are in the body that transmit the concept or the feeling both of pain have been stupefied by the drugs themselves. And then when they're allowed to become fully conscious to whatever level they are, they go kind of berserk and they send really bad pain messages to the person, to the brain, to the person. Because as far as they know, they've been out of the loop for a long time. They've been looped and they've been drugged. And so now their job is to just keep sending pain messages at the highest level they possibly can. Because as far as they're concerned, they've been taken out of a very important role, which is to let us know that there's pain. So they're going to really let us know there's pain, even if there isn't a real cause for the pain any longer. They will trigger you and let you think there's the same pain you started with as soon as the withdrawal starts. I hope that makes some sense. So be cautious about that element, because I know some people would like to use 5-HT-GSIC to get off of drugs. Well, there's more to it from what I just explained than just stopping and trying the 5-HT-GSIC. Now, and for the rest of the folks, 5-HT-GSIC is just amazing. It is very scalar, so you can use it in greater and greater levels for more and more pain. And it works. Take more, get more pain relief. And it relieves pain by moving energy in and out of minor centers. We have hundreds of them. And so each person has a unique way that their body uses 5-HT-GSIC. Everybody's going to have a little bit different response, depending upon what centers are causing their pain. 5-HT-GSIC works on about 350 centers out of 370 some odd. So, I mean, most of the centers, it has some effect on. Now, some of the centers, it has a minimal effect on, and others, it's more effective. It's just you got to pick and choose when you make something like this, because otherwise it becomes unwieldy to make and more difficult to take, and people will be taking senselessly stuff for that they don't need it for, because it was made to be too something for everybody. So there's some kinds of pain we kind of didn't pay that much attention to. 5-HT-GSIC in a minor way may have a minor effect on those pain, kinds of pain, but we didn't design it for that, because those people, by helping those few people, we went after the majority of people, the masses of people. Then we wouldn't be able to help the larger groups of people, which is the most sane way to make something. Okay. So, good news is that it really works. This stuff really works. And just so you know, it's so effective that, although it probably won't be available for 6 months to a year, we're working on an extra strength version of the same formula. And if it works, I don't know if it will. If it works, it could be significantly stronger. But that may be about a year from now before you would be able to buy it. And in the meantime, you still can use what we've got, because it's plenty strong for most people. We just need a stronger version for some kinds of extreme pains. That 5-HT would be better if it was stronger for those kinds of pains. Okay, so back to what I was talking about. I use the word scalar, and it's very interesting. That word is used in physics. It turns out that if a Higgs particle exists, it's called a scalar Higgs, a scalar particle. And it's kind of a weird thing, but if this particle actually exists, it tends to be a particle with no spin. It will be a zero-spin particle, which means we know that something has no spin. It is asexual, and it only moves in a straight line. It doesn't move in any curved lines. And this has tremendous understanding. If you can apply this metaphysical and physics, if you're looking for a Higgs particle, it would go a long way to a physicist if they really believe what I just said and tailored their experiments to that. The chances of finding a Higgs particle, if it really exists, would go way up by just using what I just explained. But I don't know how many physicists who are working on that kind, you know, at a large collider are going to be listening. Maybe some. If you are, drop me a line. I can tell you more about what you might want to try, in my opinion, my humble opinion. Okay, so the universe basically is designed from God's mind, and specifically, that energy follows God's thought, and that energy eventually will go back to the state of being intelligent in its activity after life takes this energy on each of the planes of existence and makes it more and more intelligent in its activity. Now, what does that mean? That means that less and less energy is needed for any particular activity, including all forms of communication. So it takes less and less energy as it becomes more and more intelligent. When it becomes perfectly intelligent, it takes no energy to do anything, and energy has become pure intelligent activity. And that's the state, the only place it's in that state right now in the universe is in the monadic plane or monadic dimension, where the monads just don't use the intelligent activity that's there, and they convert it by lowering it into the spiritual plane to their thought. They sacrifice it, and then they say, oh, I'll give it to them the life that's going to be created from my spirit. And so it's really interesting that it starts off in perfectly intelligent, and eventually it becomes part of a life form. A life form that is using energy in such a perfect way that life form resembles God and has become a perfected living being in our universe. Wow, you didn't know they exist? Well, they're in very low numbers at the present time, but they're called, some people call them very advanced masters, you know. There's lots of different names for them. But the point is that these beings are not part of the human kingdom. They're way beyond human. And they have ascended to the first dimension above the monadic, called the logoic or plane of Adi, or there's different names for it. And in this dimension, they actually are sharing the dimension with other beings like themselves. They are ascended monads. So what these beings are is they're beings that at one point were human and went beyond to superhuman and eventually rejoin with their monad and ascend out of the monadic plane into the logoic plane, or the first plane of the universe, where God is, and experience the universe past, present, and future as a created part of their existence. And they do this by becoming perfectly intelligent in all their actions. They join the three parts of God's mind perfectly. And they are not energy any longer. They don't respond or are part of the energy. They are a perfected being. Wow. They're called ascended monads, technically. Some call them supermasters, ascended masters, the highest of the high masters. Some call them ninth level initiates. Another name for them. Like I said, they have a lot of names. But all these great beings still have the specificity of the monad that they were connected to that came from a certain planet. So they are individuals and unique. As a matter of fact, they're more unique than any other life that exists in our universe because they have self-created themselves into a godlike being. Wow. They share God's experience, all of God's experiences, up to the time they leave our universe. And they share a virtual universe of creation from the time just before they leave our universe till the end of our universe. It's different for each one of them. That makes them even more an individual and a unique being. But God is becoming a super part of all this because God is growing from each one of these beings' experiences. It's really a neat process. And it's wonderful. And it's amazing. Okay. That's our future, by the way. I know. It may take a little time to get there. But, you know, if you think about it, if one's future is to become godlike, and to go beyond that, and eventually to enter another more advanced universe, and who knows what growth becomes, the great growth becomes in that universe. There's no end to it. There is no end. Wow. Just amazing. Absolutely amazing. Now, you notice that God, eventually this universe will end. Now, some people say it goes through 100 cycles, but I don't know. It doesn't really matter. Eventually it's going to end. And when the universe ends, the kind of reverse process of how each dimension is created, etc., takes place. And it collapses back outward, in a sense, into being a God. And eventually all beings, all life, will leave our universe. And all life should leave our universe successfully. Some of it will choose evil and other things for part of its existence. Not too smart, because that's not a good thing. It's going to create a lot of suffering for itself and other stuff. But that's its choice. And God said, hey, that's okay. If something wants to choose to ignore who and what I am, that's all right. You may not like what you find at the end of that trip, but that's okay for you to do. You're free. You got the freedom. And, you know, you don't have to believe in or believe of what you hear God thinks or says. You can do your own thing. All right, so the universe eventually is going to fall out of itself, and each dimension will become part of the next higher dimension until all the dimensions become the logoic dimension and then there are none left. So it's a fascinating part of the whole system. You might say, well, then what happens? Well, then God, the God of our universe, says, hey, time to create another universe, but this time it isn't going to be a physical one. I'm going on to create one like an astral universe where there's going to be four parts, maybe more, to my mind instead of three. You might say, well, what's the big deal of adding one more part to your mind? Well, it gets a little complicated when you're talking about the size of a universe. You add one more part, and it's not geometrical. It's truly going to escalate on an exponential scale. So that's going to be an even more interesting kind of universe. Wow. So you get to be a more interesting kind of creator. in that kind of universe. I find that fascinating in and of itself. That's really something to look forward to. So, unlike the doom and gloom shows I've sometimes been doing in recent times, this is not doom and gloom. This is all greatness. No matter how bad things seem to be on Earth right now, we're in a little glitch of a time. Don't worry. Be happy. Because the ultimate of our universe is that we're all going to be great, 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 great beings, and we're all going to be godlike, and eventually we all will become a god. Wow. Because there's a universe of gods that creates gods, where our God ultimately has some relationship to. But remember that ultimately the beginning of God is from a field of infinite possibilities. Even though we can claim that gods could be made in the universe of gods, it doesn't change anything I said about God coming from an infinite field of possibilities. That's what makes a god, by definition. Okay. So how does all this affect us today? What's the practical meaning of this? Well, there's tremendous meaning if you start applying it to faith, and to religion, and to some of the terrible problems we're having. Middle East right now is a powder keg, huh? And, you know, the first thing is that when you create countries or support countries that are dictatorial and don't have freedom, you're denying part of God's existence. And you're also not loving the people in that country. Now, this is unfortunate because there's so many countries that have dictators. And some of them the United States supports. And you can say, well, we're like God. We don't want to force countries to follow our ways. Well, I don't know about that. If I was given $1.5 billion a year to, like, in Egypt, I'm just giving an example now, and they were dependent on another $20 or $30 billion a year in trade from various treaties they have and other conditions that we supply in terms of businesses, et cetera, over there. I love Egyptian cotton sheets and bathtubs. But in any rate, that's not the only thing about Egypt that's cool. But in any rate, getting to the point I'm making, if I was doing this thing, because I'm not, and this has been done for a long time, the wrong way, in my opinion, I would start making anything we give based upon others' virtue, not based upon what they're going to give back to us. And once you do that, then you say, hey, Egypt, you know, Mubarak and all the other guys and the whole slew of dictator people, this is what the deal is. You want money, you want trade agreements, you want income, you need us for a lot of things. You want tanks, I guess, and airplanes, although they get a lot of that stuff from Russia. Here's the deal. We'll give you good deals on everything. We'll help you. But here's our plan for you guys becoming freer, more virtuous, more loving, more democratic, and more free enterprise and free markets. You got all that going, we'll be really helpful. You don't do those things, we're out of here, and that's too bad for you. Even though we like the Suez Canal, we need oil and all that stuff, you know what? It isn't worth the price. Now, you got to have some balls to do that if you're president of the United States or Congress and Senate especially. I mean, you know, that's our problem. We don't have the ability to stand up for what is right most of the time. We give lip service at best, but we won't put any teeth behind it. And then we make deals with these dictators that ends up creating monsters because that makes them more powerful and more capable, using our own weapons sometimes, to continue on in their dictatorship and their tyranny. Okay, so that's something to think about. And how does all this come out of what I was talking about with God? Well, first of all, I am slyly pulling at something that's happening at the moment, current event. But besides that, you got to look at it from this way. It's God's mind. God's mind made this universe. And if we're not going to respect God's mind, we're going to get bumped around a few times and hurt pretty badly. Last week I said God's not on our side because we're not on God's side. We're not trying to create more virtue in the world. We're selfish and manipulative and controlling of our interests, which we think it is to our interest, to somehow have some tyrant crackpot guy run a country for 30 years into the ground, where the average person makes $2.05 an hour or something, making bed sheets for us. They're great bed sheets. But at $2.05 an hour, that's pretty bad news. Actually, I forgot. It's not $2.05 an hour. It's $2.05 a day. A day. That's right. Yeah. $2.05 an hour, those people would probably be jumping for joy with. That's the average wages. Okay. And of course, they're not doing much to buy our goods at that price either. But we get cheap goods from them, you can say that. And why does Egyptian cotton cost so much? That's another thing to think about. Someone's getting rich. Probably the people that suck up to the tyrannical ruler. Okay, now, he's not the worst ruler in the world. He's not the craziest. And he's helped us with various political issues in the other countries. Those are all good things. I give him points for that. But that doesn't change the thing. Mubarak, whatever his name is. The guy's been around doing bad things to his people. Maybe good things for us. Maybe even good things to some other countries. And that's so good for his people. Watch out. Bad things could really go bad. It could really happen to most. Okay, because there's karma. When you have bad karma, that could come out. Okay, so God's mind is really critical. And understanding the fundamental basis that the whole universe is created from God's mind should give us some thought to maybe start trying to co-create with God and God's thought and pay attention to creating virtue. And maybe that's a really good thing. Now, I want us to get back to the faith issue and to religion. This is one of the reasons many people today no longer go to churches or synagogues, because they find the definition of God and the explanation of what God is and does to be either simplistic or just plain silly, and doesn't explain the world around them. I'm not saying that there should be an angel's wisdom religion. I'm saying it would be great if most religions, if not all, were to adopt a more universal kind of God principle that is not just a loving God or a creative God or a God of fire and energy or God of this or that. How about a God that's the real God, as I've been trying to describe tonight? How about a God that's so amazingly inclusive that the very thought of killing anyone over what God is the most ridiculous, oxymoron, crazy, contradictory thing ever made? It's out to lunch completely to even have a name for it. Jihad, whatever. the nuts. That's what it is. It's not God. It's everything God isn't. And then some. All right. So religions need to become grown up. They have to develop themselves to a new place. And that happens by the people who are members in a religion demanding it or leaving. For heaven's sake, don't stay in a religion because you believe with 50% of it and the other 50% is hideous and crazy. Go start your own or find another one that isn't nutso. And use principles that make sense to you. And some of those principles are in tonight's show and are many, 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 many of the hundreds of other shows that I've done. And the books I've written other things. So you have the ability to make a change in your life about faith and about religion. I truly think that if most people had a concept about God closer to what I talk about, we would have a much, much better world. Seriously. Not because I want to be ruling over them with my vision of God. Heck, I could care less about ruling anybody. I don't want to rule people. Because that's isn't what God is. God doesn't want to rule people. God wants to give people the greatest abilities to grow themselves and to be co-creative if they choose to with God, but also if they choose not to, to still give them every opportunity to be self-created and to do whatever they can do within the universe. Isn't that something? I mean, if every religion was like that, we would have an amazing world because most people are religious. Like way over in the 90 percentile are throughout the world. Granted, about 10% of the United States may be either atheistic or agnostic and do not follow any faith, but that's still a very small number, truly. And, you know, I'm sure the atheists are going to say, no, it's 11.216%. Because they did a poll in some county in someplace. I'm just saying them as average. It's about 1 out of 10 people saying, nope. Now, about 1 out of 7 or 8 people follow a very, strict faith. That's different than not believing in God. You could say, hey, none of the faiths are quite up to where I want them to be, but I strongly believe in God, and so you're one of the 9 out of 10 that have a belief or more in God. And some of the stuff I'm explaining here, you don't actually have to have a belief in God. Right about. You don't really have to have a lot of faith. All you have to do is have an open mind and test a lot of these theories out to see how true they are. That's what I like about Ageless Wisdom, is it is testable for the most part. Whereas a lot of religious stuff you can't, because the Bible tells you so. You either believe a certain Bible, Old Testament, New Testament, Quran, or whatever, or you don't, because that's how some religions run themselves. But there are still good things, even in some of those books, some of those writings and teachings. Worthwhile to read, even if you don't necessarily follow all parts of it. Because the more parts and more sides of God we can see, the more conscious we will become about God. It's better to see as much as possible, even if you don't think it's all necessarily correct. It's good. Okay. So that's one practical way of applying some of the issues about God that we found. Another way is about how men and women get along. we don't get along that well, particularly in highly developed, first-tier, first-kind of developed economically countries like the United States, many others. How do I know that? Because we don't seem to be able to stay together. Even when we have children, we get divorced half the time or so. I mean, that's not very good. Those are not high marks. And the children pay for it. We pay for it. What's wrong? Well, we need to identify those things that are feminine and are more dominant in women, and those things that are masculine, more dominant in men. Now, this is kind of like going against the 70s, you know, the 1970s, when women got all their, you know, equality rights. But being different doesn't mean you're not equal. Equality is something that has to do with opportunity, and usually is created from two different sources. It comes from laws, and it comes from God. We are equal under the eyes of God and should have equal opportunity by the laws of God, if you want to call it that. But then we also make laws and give those the rights to governments to dictate how, in some circumstances, we either do or do not have equality. But between men and women, equality has always been there. We just have been unable to understand the two sides of God's mind properly. And the equality is there, but it's on God's side. And man has chosen to not see God. And therefore, particularly when men choose to not see God, they have overpowered, because one of the things that they have stronger than women is will and the ability to use it in a little stronger way than women have, so they've become more dominant in some circumstances. Now, can a woman have a strong will as a man? Yes. But I'm talking about in the past and over the ages, that's not true. Men have dominated women because of consistency of choices, but women have invariably been more inclusive, more loving, and have carried on producing the offspring. So men may be creators, and even in some sense, you could say there can't be another person made if you don't have sperm. Of course, that could change someday, but that's the way it is right now. But, and the Y chromosome. But regardless, that's the men's creation really has to do outside of that part of the relationship. And women contribute through their nurturing and through their ability to bear and raise children in a way that is more inclusive. Men raise children, but usually through the adoption of creation and will as being the dominant features, so that they try to make sure that their children have choices and they learn how to create choices for themselves. But at the same time, it's the women that provide the structure and the holding together of family, etc. When women stop recognizing the importance of that role and they try to adopt the role of men, then you end up with the problems that we see in our society today. And some of that has to do with neither side understanding the other. Now, am I saying that women shouldn't have equal rights? No, I'm saying just the opposite. I'm saying women should have all the rights equally of God, and that we should change all the laws in this country to give women equal rights under the law. But at the same time, women should relish, they should see the tremendous gifts they have in the things that they are better at doing than men on an average. This is the problem, because we confused equality with sameness, and we reason. They don't have the same kinds of strengths and weaknesses. They have opposing ones, actually. And it's good, because that's part of the relationship that men and women can have in developing a true, lasting relationship. Each other supplies something to the other instead of compete. Now, does that mean women shouldn't work? They shouldn't have creative lives. They shouldn't have the ability to be creators if they choose. No. It means just the opposite. It just means that they might be better at some things than men are, and vice versa, on an average. Whereas there are some women that are going to be way better than most men are in some things that men are generally better at. That's okay. That's individuality and the uniqueness of being a human being. So all of this is coming from what? My definition of God. My explanation of how God created the universe. It was from spins. The spinning element that we ended up with sexuality. One kind of spin produces a more inclusive. That doesn't mean that men aren't inclusive. And one produces a more willful or creative element. But that doesn't mean women aren't creative. It just means that there's more of one than the other in each. Very, very interesting. So there is a tremendous amount that can be applied to us in this day and age and maybe solve some problems that we're having. Maybe we can reduce our divorce rate. Maybe we can improve relationships between men and women. Now, what about people who are homosexual? Well, those folks do have some problems because they can't benefit as much from the relationship, and those relationships oftentimes are difficult to maintain because they don't have this inherent advantage. Doesn't mean it can't happen. But there's other issues, too, because of sexuality. Part of sexuality is to experience the other person in their differences. But if they're the same sex as you, that becomes more difficult. And sexuality loses some of its givingness and love, since part of the process is to be the other person. And that makes homosexual people at a distinct disadvantage in terms of that level of consciousness and of sexuality and using it to help themselves to get closer to their creator. It becomes an impediment. It doesn't mean they can't be virtuous. It doesn't mean they can't be great people. It just means that it doesn't act as a positive in their relationship with another person or in them, their development of themselves. They have to become better despite that. Whereas heterosexual people don't have that obstacle. Sometimes obstacles are okay. They may be worthwhile to have because then the person will strive more to overcome it. But a lot of times the obstacle itself becomes such an impediment that it may cause the reverse. And some people may pay a penalty for choosing to be homosexual. You can say, yeah, but they didn't choose. They were born that way. Some people are born that way because in a prior life they already were homosexual. That's true. There's a karmic factor in the inherent genes that come from that. But that's not the issue. The main thing is that homosexuality has to do with a really misunderstanding on a deep level and of the spin element of God. That's really what it's about. And it's a very strange thing because that means that there's some side to a person that's disordered in their personality that they can't see a part of God. They may be great in many other respects, but that part they just don't get. It's very interesting. So the person of the opposite sex to them, they direct some of their animus towards, they direct some of the rejection towards, and it may prohibit them from developing the correct feelings towards them. So I call it a sort of disorder of the personality. I realize today, psychologically, that's been excluded. But in a metaphysical and spiritual side, it is. Does that mean I somehow don't like people who aren't sexually oriented towards people the opposite sex? No. It doesn't mean that. It means that we should all like and love people based upon who and what they are to us and to others around us. And treat them accordingly. Some people who have this, though, do become sometimes obnoxious. Well, if they do, that's them. Not necessarily because they are or are not homosexual, but they are disordered in some way, and it causes people not to like them. So God is part of everything that we're doing. Our sexuality is part of it. And could we be asexual? Well, possibly. The issue here is that there's a tremendous benefit to sexuality and life. Yes, there's some life that is asexual, but that side is usually not even close to the developmental levels of humans. Most of the more advanced developmental sides of life are sexual, and it's not coincidental. It's because it's a very big benefit to development, to the development of consciousness. And only things with limited consciousness find asexuality of no great problem for them. It's not an impediment because their consciousness is so limited it's not going to change anything anyway. So they don't care about sexuality, and they don't have it necessarily in their species. But for us, and for a lot of mammals and higher life forms, sexuality is a major part of the development of consciousness in so many different ways. It doesn't mean that in animals they are going to stay together for life the way humans could or might, but it does say that the fact that they have any sexuality at all is being an important benefit to them and helping them to move on. So, at any rate, I'm hoping that this is starting to make some sense, that there's a lot to be gained from all this physics mumbo-jumbo and understanding how the universe is made, because it is applicable to how we live on a daily basis, who we are, the nature of God, and us being part of God is like two peas in the pod. We've got to work with that understanding, if we're going to really unravel the meaning of our life and grow it and develop it to the point where it's really significant and it's a wondrous, amazing thing. If you're down and if you're out and if you're depressed, this is a good thing to think about because it sort of empowers you to becoming, you know, more educated and more aware, to be able to change what may be right now looking at a bad short-term future. I mean, you know, things are not going all that great in the world or here in the United States, but we do have the opportunities to change our own life on a personal level, and we can share this with others, which hopefully can grow and change the problems that in prior shows I've laid out for you. So we have these, and this is our legacy. This is what we are here to do. So it's an amazing thing. Well, we are really out of time, and I want to say I hope that tonight's show has given you, I wish I had more time to really develop all the other parts of how this scenario with God would apply, but we'll get into it in the future. So until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.